committed explicitly to the work of one experimenter, allowing them to do it properly without having to worry about coordinating with other experimenters. And Kim Van Allen was certainly one of the prime movers in this direction. He started the expansion of the black corporal development to the Araby form. He also had a strong role together with some people at ONR in developing the Raccoon, which was a combination of a Deacon rocket, a 9-foot solid propellant motor about 6 inches in diameter, which could be carried to 80,000 feet on a Skyhook balloon, and then ignited at that altitude to go on up to 70 or 80 kilometers. In fact, many of them went well done 100 kilometers. So we began to look at those as possibilities for doing simple photometric experiments. The only other person, it seems to me, in the period around 1950-51, who was using these rockets was Van Allen himself. He had a basic experiment, which was a Geiger counter, which he flew at every opportunity, and each time produced a nice map of the Poisson distribution at about 80,000 feet, followed then by a decline to the effective cosmic ray background outside the atmosphere. And his mission was to do this all over the Earth at all longitudes and latitudes, and I think he very nearly successfully accomplished that. In order to go to higher latitudes, where he didn't have the facilities for ground-based launch of the Araby, he went into the Raccoon work, and a number of these Raccoons were flown from a Coast Guard cutter, the East Wind, up in the Arctic region. When we asked for Araby rockets out of our rocket research panel's allocations, we had no trouble getting them. We asked for rocket, and they said, well, how many do you want? And so we said, well, we use three at a time. And there was no objection to that. Everybody was still looking greedily at the Viking because it had such a big payload and such a high altitude capability. What could you do with a rocket which was not likely to get above about 80 kilometers? Well, we thought we could see hard X-rays and Lyman Alpha, and it was worth flights just for studying those radiations. So we went into that program, and our first three rockets all worked very well. Each one went over 90 kilometers. And we got good data on Lyman Alpha, the 2100 angstrom region of the ultraviolet, and X-rays. We then thought of stretching the Araby rocket, simply extending the fuel tanks, and by that simple means, getting higher altitude. This was done. We began to get about 130 kilometers with these. And by that time, our colleagues had changed their minds about the Araby, and there was a great rush to get solidly into the Araby program, and that has been the situation ever since. But I'd like to talk a little about some interesting expeditions we have with Raccoons and with the follow-ons of the Raccoons, the first stage rockets, what we call the push-button rocket technique. We had learned enough about the quiet sun so that we began to wonder about what happened during solar flares. And looking at the ionospheric behavior became clear to Dr. Chen and myself that even though Lyman Alpha was absorbed in the D region and presumably produced the D region by ionization of nitric oxide, which is a trace constituent at that altitude, we could not see how a flash of Lyman Alpha could account for the sudden ionospheric disturbance phenomenon. It would have required an increase in Lyman Alpha by a factor of something like 10 to the 5th, which was an astrophysical impossibility. And on the other hand, if the X-ray spectrum were stretched to a shorter wavelengths into the 1 to 2 angstrom region, X-rays could reach the D region's lowest levels, and it would take very, very little in X-ray flux to account for the sudden ionospheric disturbances. So we decided to generate a program which would look for X-ray radiation and Lyman Alpha during solar flares and answer this very simple question. The difficulty, of course, was that the liquid fuel rockets at White Sands couldn't be kept on the launching stands for long periods of time while we waited for the flares to push the button. And the only thing which had this push-button characteristic at the time was the Raccoon. So we organized an expedition which we called San Diego High. We were given the services of an LSD, a landing ship dock, the USS Colonial, and we sailed out of San Diego about 400 miles southwest of San Diego off the California coast to do these experiments. May we have the next slide, please? The LSD has a nice flight deck for helicopter work at its tail, and we use that deck to launch this combination of rocket and balloon. And the typical procedure was to run the ship with the wind so that the balloon would stand straight up on the deck during the launch. Once launched, and the next slide please, here you can see the balloon carrying the rocket and the corner reflectors for the radio tracking and the igniter system which was carried in a package down below the motor of the rocket. Once the balloon got up to altitude, presumably it would float there during the day, we had teletype links with Sacramento Peak and with the High Altitude Observatory at Climax. They would watch for solar flares. At the first hint of a flare, they would send us a message, and we would decide on the basis of what it looked like, whether we would fire the rocket, and hope that the flare would develop within the next few minutes while the rocket reached altitude. Typically, the rocket would float at 80,000 feet. Not float, it would fly at considerable speed. And it would be quite a chase for the Colonial, which would get up to about 26 knots, to try to keep the Raccoon within radio command range. We could not simply let it go, escape from us, because of the hazard of the rocket coming down in some populated area later on. We were obliged to cut it down at the end of each day if we didn't see a flare. And we were fortunate to have a destroyer working with us. I think it was the USS Perkins, which could do over 30 knots and stay a little closer to this balloon caught up in the high altitude winds. But each day it was quite a chase, and we didn't have many days where we could keep it within range for the full length of the day. Also, the sun was not very cooperative. We had 10 rockets, and it was only on the last day that we had a flare of class 1 magnitude and were able to get the information we were after. There were problems which were typical at the time that one doesn't worry about nowadays. Even though this was presumably a working system, nobody had ever developed a suitable igniter for this beacon to work at 80,000 feet, essentially, in vacuum. Jim Perrigan, who was one of our team at that time, was designated the chief gunner's mate for this problem, because the first time we put one up, we couldn't get it to ignite. We had to cut it down without firing a rocket. And Jim had a lot of experience as a boy working with his chemistry set, making gunpowder. And that was the most experience anybody had. So each day he sat down with his mortar and pestle and ground up his gunpowder and made up his little igniter, and then we prayed that it would work when we pushed the button. We had a few failures after that, but he eventually licked the problem and the igniter began to work at altitude. When the system finally did work on this class 1 flare, we got a very strong X-ray signal, no change in Lyman alpha, and we essentially answered this fundamental question that a solar flare produces an intense burst of X-rays and relatively little change in the ultraviolet. This type of program was continued through the IGY, but by that time we were able to combine the Nike booster with a second stage and launch from the ground. This was a tremendous improvement in this kind of technology and push-button rocketry. Next slide, please. Our most ambitious program was an attempt to study the distribution of ultraviolet and X-rays over the surface of the Sun during the course of a solar eclipse. And in the IGY, 1958, there was such an eclipse which crossed the Pacific Ocean and could be observed with its longest duration in the South Pacific, a few hundred miles from Samoa, over a tiny coral atoll called the Danger Islands. In particular, the island we used was Puka Puka. And an expedition was organized of ground-based astronomers and our rocket team from NRL. The ground-based group went ashore on the island, and we operated off another LSD, the USS Point Defiance. And we used this very crude system. We made up simple tripods to mount the rockets. They were spaced about 20 feet apart on the helicopter deck. Below the rockets, for blast deflection, we put down quarter-inch steel armor plate. And again, we kept our fingers crossed. We didn't have any idea what would happen when we fired the rocket. Would one rocket set off all the others and have everything go up in one grand fireworks display? The Nike booster, I don't know how many of you have stood close to a Nike booster. It's quite an awesome device when it goes off. Essentially, it's a 1,000-pound bomb. And we had very little experience with them. We weren't sure that we wouldn't sink the Point Defiance. The night of the first one, the captain of that ship, who had the glamorous name Captain Woodhead. had full trust in us. We made sure not to confide any of our reservations to him. In fact, on the day of the eclipse, the crew lined up on the observation deck, barely 100 feet of rockets, and out in full view with very little protection. Any safety officer today would quiver at the thought. Operating in the South Pacific gave us lots of other troubles, the moisture, humidity problem. We found we had to put plastic bags over the noses of the rockets. I don't know whether you can see it in this picture. We had 2x4s strapped to the tripods, and the plastic bags put over the 2x4s with simple powder arrangements to haul them up just a few minutes before firing. The bags were filled with drying compound in the hope that we could keep the electronics dry enough to work. Well, during the course of the eclipse, everything went right, I think, for the first four shoots. We got to the fifth shoot, pressed the button, and nothing happened. So we went to rocket number six and pressed the button, and nothing happened. And what we diagnosed as a trouble was that the shocks of the previous four firings had loosened the connectors from the firing system to the rockets, and they had to be pushed back in again. Well, without any hesitation, John Lindsley ordered Don Rousseau to do something. And while he promised Don that he would hold the firing key up in full view, Don ran out and climbed the tripods and pushed the cables back into the rockets, and then ran for his life to the nearest gun tub, which was only about 50 feet away. John Lindsley went back in, inserted the firing key, and we went through the remaining shoots. Actually, we fired only the next rocket and saved the last one for the calibration chute on the next day. And without any attempt to hold it for a flare, right in the middle of this chute, there was a beautiful Class 2 flare, which was worth an awful lot to us. Well, let me have the lights, please. We moved from the Sun to stars beyond the Sun came about this time too. Although the jump was a very big one, the light of all the stars combined the ultraviolet was only about a billion for the ultraviolet intensity of the sun. And so one needed a great gain in sensitivity in order to pick up stars, and we could only hope to pick up the brightest early type stars in the ultraviolet. Those of you who remember some of those early rockets know that if you walked into Ted Byron's laboratory, you could see 4-inch and 6-inch mirrors all over the place. We used to load an RV with as many of these as we could put in with UV photon counters or ionization chambers at the foci of these small mirror telescopes, launch the rocket, let it spin, and pick up stars that pass through the field view. And in retrospect, we really did very well, because in a typical flight, one could pick up about 200 stars in the ultraviolet. And this work laid the foundation for the concept of the OAO program. The OAO 1 took off from these early beginnings, and of course, it's been a magnificent extension of this early rocket work. Those of you who attended the last Astronomical Society meeting, I think, could help but be impressed with the tremendous amount of information that's come back on UV photometry and the ultraviolet from the first successful OAO. I talked about the mirror telescopes, but actually we started with very much simpler efforts. Our first detectors were simply the photon counters, and we left the fields of view open fairly wide, about 20 degrees. And we got a spectacular result on the first attempt, because as soon as the rocket exceeded about 80 kilometers, the Lyman alpha sensitive detectors were overwhelmed with what we now know as the Lyman alpha air bubble, or the geocoronal glow. This was the way that hydrogen geocorona was discovered. In order to define that phenomenon a little better, we then went to using collimators made up of bundles of hypodermic needles, which restricted the field of view to about 3 degrees. These gave discrete star signals and also permitted the production of a contour map of Lyman alpha, which showed the minimum in the antisolar direction and provided the basis for the theoretical analyses, which showed that it really was a geocoronal cloud surrounding the Earth that was resonantly scattering solar radiation into the night sky. Today, there is a tremendous amount of excitement over the discoveries that are coming along in high energy astronomy. A number of my colleagues in astronomy, in talking about how things develop, like to refer to X-ray astronomy as a good example of the serendipity of how simply by looking in an unknown region of the spectrum, one discovers things that he never expected to see. And that this was the sort of thing that happened in the earliest discoveries in X-ray astronomy. The first evidence for the emission of X-rays distinct from the sun came from the work of the AS&E group, Rossi, Giacconi, Paolini, in 1962. They were conducting a program to observe X-rays excited on the surface of the moon by fluorescence. And when this is referred to typically, experiment is described as a search for lunar X-rays, with the X-ray discovery that came out of it as something that was a total surprise to everybody involved. But we can go back to these first Drakoon experiments in 1956. And in our payload, we not only have the beryllium window type of X-ray detector, we carry a scintillation counter to search for harder X-rays. And On two occasions, when we launched the rocket in the absence of a solo player, we were able to get signals on the scintillation counter. I think the next slide, please. Let's go to the next one. Oh, I shouldn't disperse this here, but I'll hold this. While we have the slide, this is a recovery device. Since I was talking about eclipses in 1958, I wanted to show that the do-it-yourself approach and the excitement that characterized all of our earlier efforts still carries over into the work of the group here at NRL today. In the eclipse of 1970, Gunter Bruckner and his group in the rocket sound branch, in the rocket spectroscopy branch, had to recover their rocket from the bottom of the sea with this device, which is called Curve 3, which has a means for moving along the ocean bottom and searching with TV eyes for the package one is hunting for, grappling with this grappling device, and bringing it to the surface. But let me talk about this as long as we have a slide. On the occasion of this eclipse, a very elegant experiment had been designed by Bruckner and his associates. Everything worked perfectly in flight. It was clear that the results would be very valuable, but the recovery system failed. The rocket went to the bottom of the ocean off Wallops Island to a depth of 6,000 feet. And Bruckner would have been thoroughly justified in shedding tears and going home, getting drunk, and forgetting about the whole thing. But those of you who know how persistent he is, and he pursued the possibility of recovery. This device was brought from the West Coast, and about 2 weeks elapsed from the time the rocket hit the bottom to when it was brought to the surface. Every conceivable reason could be given for expecting nothing but total junk to be found. The pressure of water at that depth would crush the equipment. If undoubtedly seawater would leak into the film compartments, corrosion of magnesium was expected to be very serious, but fortunately one of the cassettes is encoded with Teflon. The corrosion was almost totally inhibited, and before it was brought to the surface, Eastman Kodak advice was sought, and prescriptions were developed for how to handle film that had been in water, in salt water, at this temperature for this long a time. And to everybody's amazement, they were able to develop the film, get spectra, and recover a very large proportion of the scientific results that they had been looking for. Well, let's go on now to the next slide. I want to talk again about the search for X-rays in that 1956 expedition. Typically, at low altitudes, 23 kilometers, one sees the atmospheric emission of hard radiation. And as the rocket rises, it gets above this radiation until at a height of 110 to 114 kilometers, it is essentially above it, looking out into space. And there we saw a spectrum ran from our lower limit, about 30 keV, all the way on up to about 250 keV. In the next slide, years later on, when we plotted it on the early results of people who were looking at the X-ray background radiation, these three diamond points are the points off that early Raccoon work, and they fit very reasonably on the extended X-ray background spectrum. In 1958, Kuparian and I reported these results to the Astronomical Union meeting in Moscow, and we suggested that this was a diffuse X-ray background. I talked with Brent Hoyle about whether perhaps this could be X-rays resulting from the Bremsstrahlung of a hot intergalactic gas, which would result from the decay of neutrons produced in the continuous creation theory. His theory at that time, his and Tom Gold's, specified that the material which was continuously created was neutrons. The neutrons decayed into electrons and protons, and the effective temperature of this intergalactic gas was about 10 to the 9th degrees in what would expect a high energy X-ray spectrum. But when we made some rough estimates of what would be predicted, our X-ray observations were about a factor of 50 below his predictions for that continuous creation theory, and so we dropped that hypothesis. Of course, we know that the accepted theory now is that the background X-rays are produced by inverse Compton scattering of cosmic ray electrons which escape from active galaxies into the intergalactic medium. At least that is the very crude general consensus. The details of these theories of background radiation are still in a very primitive stage. But may I have the lights, please, again? I've been rambling on this way for almost an hour and have only talked about the earlier era, hardly gotten past the Sputnik age. But those of you who've been in the field in recent years know how exciting the pace of discovery is. I would hate to stop talking at this point without mentioning some of the things that have happened within the last year, at least very quickly, which are perhaps the most exciting results that I can recall in 25 years of this kind of work. Amongst the new objects which have been detected in the X-ray spectrum, I think the detection of the secret galaxy NGC 1275 of Perseus A rates probably highest. Can we look at the 25 millimeter, 35 millimeter slides, please? Look at the first one. I think I have a picture of the galaxy and the spectrum which we observed. It's very interesting that this spectrum is extremely steep. And if one integrates under the spectrum, see it's an e to the minus 3 photon power spectrum, one gets a flux which is certainly comparable to the intense infrared flux which has been found for these strong secret galaxies. For those of you who are not quite familiar with secret galaxies, they are too a relatively recent discovery. I think they date back to about 1943. They constitute about 1% of all normal galaxies, so-called normal spiral galaxies. And they're characterized by extremely intense bright cores. With a normal photographic exposure, one can easily confuse a secret galaxy for a star. With a longer exposure, the outer extent of the galaxy begins to show up. We can see that it approaches the size of normal galaxies. And some of them are very strong radio emitters. This particular one, 1275, Perseus A, is one of the strongest radio galaxies. And more recently, they've been observed in the infrared. The typical radio flux might be 10 to the 42 Hertz per second. In the infrared, they go up to about 10 to the 46 Hertz per second. And the infrared spectrum is strongly peaked. It peaks at around 100 microns, and then fall sharply towards the radio and essentially comes down to what we normally expect from a typical galaxy at about 2 microns. Now, in the next slide, this is a picture.